once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me in the Bettors Box. This is bettingbook.com's MLB betting podcast for Thursday, June 22nd. I am your host, Adam Burke. Glad to be back with you on the air here to talk some more Major League Baseball betting insight and analysis. This edition of the Bettors Box presented by DSI Sportsbook. If you head on over to DSI, use the promo code BTBRadio. Good for a $10 free bet just for signing up. An additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. We've got our Monday, Tuesday, Thursday format coming your way next week. However, I do want to mention no shows Monday or Tuesday of the All-Star break. We'll take a little bit of an All-Star break of my own. We'll be back on Thursday to set up the second half of the season. So I'll just give you a little bit of a heads up for that. Keep in mind all the great content that we have over at bangthebook.com. My picks analysis piece goes up every day. Also my daily fantasy piece. Wrote a couple of pieces yesterday about college football coaching changes. Never too early to start thinking about college football. We talked about that on our Tuesday Takeover show with professional bettor Brian Leonard. I wrote about the Group of Five and the Power Five head coaching changes. A couple of really long articles there, but some good stuff. Get you started on your way for the return of Pigskin, which happens here in a little bit over 2 months. But we got lots of other good content going on over there. I've got previews for the Xfinity Series and the Monster Energy Cup Series here this weekend. We've got UFC Fight Night 112, also the Bellator event, that from our buddy Tom Wilkinson over at the website. So plenty of great content, tons of game previews, stuff like that over at bangthebook.com. Don't forget about those contests as well, the Daily Streaker Contest, monthly pick of the day, and then also those cash prizes going out for the top monthly win percentage, top ROI, and top number of units won. We've got Beyond the Box Score for today. We'll go down the lines, look at a pick for Thursday night, look at a little bit of a statistic that I've been following because I've seen some line moves based on it out there in the market, and then we'll take a look at the weekend ahead, several series to preview for that. Go ahead and take a look beyond the box score to start things off today. A couple of teams I haven't talked about too much here on the show, Tampa Bay Rays, the Cincinnati Reds. The Rays just can't seem to separate in the American League East. Their underlying metrics and the standings metrics really do like them, but they take 2 out of 3 here in this series. Got some pretty good starting pitching in this one. Jake Odorizzi, 7 innings, 3 earned. Alex Cobb, 7 innings, 2 earned. Erasmo Ramirez, good bounce back start for him in Thursday's getaway day game. But they're definitely a play on team against right-handed pitching. They're now 30-20 on the season. I talked about this coming into the year, and I talked about it on a different podcast that I did as well, the Stealing Signs podcast, where you know, the Rays, to me, were a team to back against righties, fade against lefties. Well, they're 30-20 against righties, 9-16 against lefties. Lots of left-handed power on this ball club. That's how they score runs. They don't manufacture a ton of innings. They get a guy or two on, then hit a blast. It's what they do. It's what a lot of teams do nowadays in Major League Baseball. But that 30-20 record against right-handed pitching is 6th in Major League Baseball behind Houston, the Dodgers, Arizona, Colorado, and Washington. Interesting that 4 of those 5 teams there are National League teams, which is something that's been kind of surprising to me overall this year, how much better the National League has been overall offensively than the American League, and in part because you've got some outliers like the Dodgers, Arizona, Washington. Obviously, Coors Field is its own set of outliers, but pretty interesting to note that. But the Rays are the only one of those 6 teams, Houston, the Dodgers, Arizona, Colorado, and Washington, and themselves, that has a sub-500 record against left-handed pitching. So this is one of those things where you want to pick up on that trend a little bit. And Rays prices out there in the marketplace have been very, very reasonable. A big part of the reason why is because they don't have a great starting rotation outside of Chris Archer. But against righties, great return on investment so far. That's something I would fully expect to continue as we go throughout the rest of the season. In this series, all 3 of the games went over. The Reds are now 42-25 with a handful of pushes to the over here this season. Would not expect that to drop off the rest of the way. This is a good offensive team. They play in a small ballpark. They've got a subpar pitching staff. I think Homer Bailey is slated to come back this weekend maybe. And then Anthony DeSclafani should be back here at some point. But they've taken some of their more promising starting prospects. They've put them in relief roles. Robert Stevenson, Raisel Iglesias, Michael Lorenzen. You know, they let John Lamb go. They need to find some healthy arms. They need to find some arms that can work for them in this rotation. But they don't really have that in the organization right now. I don't know if at some point they trade away some of these offensive pieces to get back some pitching pieces. But for right now, the Reds are definitely an over team. that's something I would expect to continue here as we go throughout the season. They've got good power in the lineup. Joey Votto's a guy that, you know, gets things going, gets on base, and then they just don't have the pitching to back it up. The bullpen has regressed a little bit. I've liked Brian Price's leveraging of his relievers throughout the season. I still like what he's doing with that, but some of those guys have come back to earth a little bit. And, of course, the starter is not particularly good. Keep in mind, Bronson Arroyo should be retiring here shortly. Obviously, that will deal a blow to these over numbers for the Reds. But still, when you look at this team, really when you look across Major League Baseball, you know, scoring is up across the board. Some big-time outliers in terms of teams that are cashing the over a lot. The Reds are one of them. The Brewers are another one. But the Reds are one of those teams where I would expect that to continue as we go throughout the summer months here. Boston Red Sox dropped a series to the Kansas City Royals, lost 2 out of 3. This series loss goes solely on the shoulders of manager John Farrell. 8th inning, 2-run lead, had already burned Joe Kelly in the 7th, and John Farrell does not go to Craig Kimbrell with the bases loaded. Salvador Perez hits a grand slam. The Red Sox got exactly what they deserved in that game. John Farrell got exactly what he deserved in that game. When asked about it after the game, he said that wasn't Kimbrell's inning. There are a lot of things that piss me off about baseball. I love it. I love the game. I love the sport. I love digging into the stats. But when I see egregious managerial decisions like this, it really gets under my skin. And John Farrell totally effed this one up. The Royals are now just a game away from 500. I still don't really believe in them, but Lorenzo Cain and Eric Hosmer have gotten going in the middle of this lineup. They're increasing their trade value, and they're increasing the hopes of Royals fans who, sorry, are going to have their hopes dashed when this team falls out of contention and those guys get traded, because the Royals simply need to rebuild their farm system. The cost of winning is that your farm system generally takes a hit, because you go out there, you buy the players that you need using the trade currency that you have. The Royals have done that. They need to rebuild this system. So it's great that they're up there near 500. It's great that they've turned around from a really slow start to the season. But this team should look a lot different in August than it does now. At least Ned Yost finally realized that Alcides Escobar is not a leadoff hitter. Only took him 4 years and an inexplicable World Series to figure that out. But in any event, we see managerial decisions have an impact on far too many games here in 2017. And really, it's been too many games over the last few years. All of this information is out there. Run expectancy, win expectancy. And it's all done in real time. I, for the life of me, I can't figure out how these managers cannot make plus EV decisions. They just don't do it. It is the most archaic thing in the world to sit here and say that Craig Kimbrell's inning is the 9th. Craig Kimbrell's inning should be whenever the hell you need him. Managers that leverage bullpens properly are guys that I love. And yes, the Red Sox are a good team. They have plenty of talent. They have enough talent to overcome some of these decisions from John Farrell. I don't think you can throw away games like that in the American League East with the current landscape of the division, and also the fact that Toronto is playing much better. So you've got really 5 very good teams in the American League East. Well, 4 good teams in Baltimore in the American League East. But I hate it. I cannot stand it. You know, you use your best reliever when leverage dictates. A bases-loaded situation with a 2-run lead is when you use your best reliever. You know, I talk a lot about Terry Francona. I'm not a Terry Francona fan. He's great with players before the game. He's great with players after the game. He's great with the media. In-game, I don't love his decision-making. But Carlos Carrasco gets into a pickle yesterday in the 7th inning. Andrew Miller comes out. Bases loaded. Nobody out. 10 pitches. And the Orioles don't score. That's how you leverage a bullpen. That's how you use your relievers. You know, if Andrew Miller is not on the ball club, does he go to Cody Allen in that spot? If Cody Allen's available, he's now on the paternity list. Does he go to Cody Allen there? I don't know. I'm going to assume probably not. So it's probably just the luxury of having an Andrew Miller, which is something a lot of teams don't have. But spot for your primary reliever. That is a spot for your highest leverage guy, your relief ace. Farrell doesn't do it, comes back to burn him. If the Red Sox don't make their way into the playoffs, which they should, because nobody in the American League really seems interested in those wild card spots outside of the American League East, that's a game that we'll have to look back at. But that is one of those where the manager lost it. And you talk about trying to quantify the impact of a manager over the course of a season. Some estimates are 1 to 3 games. Some estimates are as many as 5 games. I don't know what the answer is, but that was one right there where John Farrell clearly cost his team the opportunity to win a series. The Cardinals are looking for a sweep of the Phillies here on Thursday. The Phillies are quite an interesting team to me right now. You know, like I talked about, I was on their season win total over last year. They overachieved in a big way, according to Pythagorean win-loss. They were a 62-win team. They actually won 71 games. This year, it's a mess. And you have young players that aren't adhering to stop signs from a third base coach. Odubel Herrera did that yesterday. Pete McKinnon is basically just a guy that's babysitting at this point. You know, he's a highly paid babysitter watching after this team to make sure nobody kills each other. And it's tough to watch. You know, I feel bad for Phillies fans who were spoiled by the good years when Chase Utley was a quality player, when Ryan Howard was still relevant, when Roy Halladay was out there dealing, Cole Hamels was in his prime. It's tough to watch what this team is now. And when you look at this series, it's kind of a microcosm of the Phillies. It was a 1-1 game on Tuesday night. They lost 8-1 in extra innings. They lose yesterday as well. Neither bullpen was able to stop the bleeding in that game. But the Phillies have played the most one-run games in baseball with 28, and they have one of the worst bullpens in baseball. So it's kind of funny how that works out, but it's one of those examples where bad teams just find ways to lose games. This is a bad team. But what I do want to talk about with the Phillies here, and there are other teams in this boat as well, the New York Mets being one of them. Whenever they call up Ahmed Rosario, which should have been done already, you know, we'll see if it's a shot in the arm for them. But the Phillies have two players, Dylan Cousins and Rhys Hoskins, that are absolutely killing AAA pitching in Lehigh Valley. They're not up yet. And I get Super 2. I understand some of these contract things that you'd be worried about. But the Super 2 deadline is pretty much passed at this point. So the Phillies should be getting better, at least offensively. Will that be a shot in the arm? Will it be nothing? You know, do the problems run too deep with this team? I mean, you look at Jerrod Eichhoff, a guy that I really like coming into the year. He hasn't pitched well. Aaron Nola still trying to get into a rhythm with some of the injury problems that he's had. He's actually on the bump here today. Nick Pivetta, back-to-back starts where his stuff looked really good. 19 strikeouts in his last two outings against Boston and St. Louis. And the Phillies have these pieces. They have these individual components, yet they can't put it all together. And then when you look at the fact that they've played so many one-run games, 28 of them, they haven't fared very well in them necessarily. It's just, it's really interesting to watch. It's just very fascinating to watch how these things play out here throughout the course of a season. And the thing that you have to wonder is, with the Phillies playing so many of these close games, if they get some of these offensive upgrades from the minor leagues, if they get Aaron Nola into rhythm, if they get Nick Pivetta to a point where he can be consistent, if Jerrod Eichhoff comes back and starts pitching better, do the Phillies become a play-on team? Do they figure it out? They could. So keep a close eye on the Phillies here as they start making some of these call-ups, as they start making some of these changes, you know, maybe look to trade some guys, restock the farm system a little bit. You know, they have the position player depth in the minor leagues to churn out a pretty good lineup. So they are a team to watch because you want to look for those buy points on teams. You want to buy low and sell high. Well, when you get to a point where you can buy the Phillies, you'll be buying very, very, very low. And I think that that time is coming. I don't know when. I'm going to keep a finger on the pulse of this team and see if I can, you know, direct our listeners in the right direction with them. But I do think that the Phillies, at some point this season, will go on a run where they win 10 out of 12, 10 out of 15, something like that, you know, and kind of make things look a little bit better cosmetically. Because, again, this is a team that's going to be well, well below 500 when it's all said and done. Wanted to mention a few random standings, trends, or notes here that I was sort of going through as I was looking for some stuff to talk about today. The Atlanta Braves have played only 14 games against a team with a 500 or better record. They're 6-8 in those 14 games. They're 27-30 against teams with a losing record. So the Braves, very light strength of schedule. That's not a big surprise because the National League East is not a good division. It's the Nationals and then four sub-500 teams. So if we look at something like that, obviously, you're going to have a situation where you're not playing a whole lot of good teams. But when the Braves do step up in class, you know, then we'll have to see how they actually fare in some of those situations. Speaking of teams that haven't played a whole lot of good teams, the Minnesota Twins, 8-21 against teams with a 500 or better record this year. They are 28-12 against teams with a losing record. Minnesota comes to Cleveland this weekend. Indians just swept a four-game series. We'll see what happens in this series. But the Twins, when they have stepped up and played somebody with a pulse, they've not played well. 8-21 in those 29 games. The Reds, 7-23 against teams that are 500 or better this year, 23-18 against teams with a losing record. So this sort of speaks to what the Reds are, a good offensive team, but good pitching will shut them down. That's why they're 7-23 against teams 500 or better. Probably a trend that will continue, but I think you can look to play on the Reds against bad teams as you go throughout the rest of the way, because I think that they can just outslug them. So maybe that is a betting angle to watch a little bit here going forward. The Oakland A's, a lineup built on power, right? You know, that, at least that's what I think of the A's as. You know, they've got some guys that have started to believe in this launch angle trend, Yonder Alonso, Jed Lowry. They've got a guy like Ryan Healy who doesn't walk a whole lot but seems to make a lot of great contact. The A's are 22-16 at home this year. They are 9-25 on the road. And when I think of a team built on power, built on this idea of hitting home runs, those are not really the splits I would expect to see with O.co Coliseum out there in Oakland. Not a great hitter's park. Tons of foul territory that takes away at bats. High walls in the alleys. Balls never really carried all that well there. But then they're pretty good at home and they're terrible on the road. And again, this speaks to that home field advantage that Oakland has when they play teams from out east that don't come out there very often. Again, this is an angle I think we can keep looking to play this year, and I don't think it's properly priced into the market either. So for Oakland, some big home road splits. I do think they get a little bit better on the road as we go throughout. But again, look for them at home against those teams that don't play there a whole lot. The Arizona Diamondbacks are 26-9 at home this season. What's interesting about this is that ballpark officials in the Diamondbacks organization announced that a humidor would be coming to Chase Field. They wanted to get pitchers to have better grip on the baseball, wanted to take away some of the offensive advantages there at Chase Field. Now, when this news broke in early April, it was said that the humidor was supposed to be installed within a month, month and a half. Well, we're more than 2 months away, almost 2.5 months away now from this news coming out, and I have not heard anything. So Arizona 26-9 at home. If the humidor does come in, what happens to their home record? Or have they realized intelligently that they should wait until after the season to put this thing in? I think it would be a huge disadvantage for Arizona to start the year and then put it in. Now, this is something you need to start right from day one. So I don't know what the plans are. I haven't heard anything. If anybody else has seen anything, please hit me up on Twitter at Skating Tripods. But I looked. Did a Google search for this, did a news search for this. Haven't seen any update since the initial statement was made about adding a humidor at Chase Field. But with Arizona 26-9 at home, I don't think they should change anything at home the way that things currently stand. Looking at a few of those standings outliers, Minnesota and Baltimore, both +5 in Pythagorean win-loss record. Again, Minnesota, a team I've talked about regression hitting for throughout the season. And then getting a chance to actually see Baltimore here with the Indians playing them. This starting rotation is awful. This bullpen without Zach Britton seems to be lacking a sense of direction. And this lineup can be beaten because it's a free-swinging lineup, very right-handed heavy. It doesn't surprise me that Baltimore's a pretty big outlier. And they're almost a yearly outlier. Buck Showalter generally leverages the bullpen very well. They've been able to out-hit some of their starting pitching problems over the last few years. But Baltimore, you know, maybe this is the year that the bottom kind of falls out. I do think in terms of the American League East, they are clearly the fifth best team in that division right now. The Yankees, they're -5 in Pythagorean win-loss because they blow out some teams and lose some close games. It's just kind of the way that things go with them. But they're the only team in Major League Baseball -5 in Pythagorean win-loss. Rockies and Padres +4, White Sox -4. Twins are the only team in baseball with a negative run differential and a winning record. So, again, not just talking out of my ass when it comes to the Twins and talking about regression. There are a lot of signs of it here with this ball club. And, again, I do think that they kind of fall off the pace a little bit as they go throughout the rest of the season. One other interesting standings note here, the Miami Marlins have already played 17 interleague games. The Dodgers have played 3. The Tigers have played 4. The Indians are 2-9 in interleague play. They're 36-23 against American League opponents. But interleague play is an interesting thing to watch for because you play unfamiliar opponents. You lose a hitter if you go to the National League. You gain a hitter if you go to the American League. Could be a boost for some teams that have backloaded interleague schedules, or it could be a detriment. Look at a team like the Dodgers, for example. Their 3 interleague games were played in Cleveland. And they got to add an extra hitter to the lineup, and they have the depth. They have the positional availability to do that. When you look at some of these other teams, take a look at the Tigers, for example. Victor Martinez currently on the DL with an irregular heartbeat, but when the Tigers go to the National League and lose a hitter, that's a big-time problem for them. So very interesting to watch this National League dynamic at play. Of course, Miami, again, with 17 interleague games so far. That's just a remarkable number relative to the rest of the league. It's just very interesting to see such a significant gap in something like that. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens here as we go forward. But, you know, again, some of these teams are going to be playing some interesting schedules as we go throughout the rest of the year here. And I'm not entirely sure big of an impact that could have on some of these playoff races, given that some teams have already put most of the interleague schedule behind them. So watch out for that. Again, losing a hitter and gaining a hitter is a pretty significant thing. Again, unfamiliar opponents, unfamiliar cities to play in. There's a comfort factor, especially when you get deep into the year and it's just the grind of the season. You know, maybe that that thing that kind of shakes you up a little bit going to a city you don't normally go to, maybe there's a little bit of excitement behind that. You know, sort of breaks up the doldrums of the season. On the other hand, you know, players like familiarity, they like routine, especially if it's a team that's got to go out and travel a long way, like the Central's playing the National League West this year. So some of these teams are going to have to make long, long trips out to cities they generally don't go to. So that'll be something to watch. I think that we could see some wagering angles coming out of interleague play the rest of the way. Go down the lines here, look at some line moves that have happened since I was last on the air with Monday's show. A general point to make here, I've noticed a lot of left on base percentage related moves here. Low left on base percentage guys took some money. High left on base percentage guys were faded. Of course, there's generally a correlation between ERA and xFIP there as well, but not always. But again, we're seeing just another one of those elements that drives the market in terms of line moves. And left on base percentage, a big statistic for determining luck, generally does tend to even out. Now, there are some outliers, some big-time outliers, based on batted ball profile, based on strikeouts, that type of thing. But, you know, we do have some guys, and I will talk about some in a little bit here, where we should be looking for some left-on-base percentage-related moves. They also fall in the ERA and xFIP category, but I will talk about them a little bit later in the show. Tuesday, we saw some Josh Tomlin money on the Indians. It's a game that they should have won. Chris Tillman made the start there for Baltimore. The Indians had some base running blunders in that game, some other things that just didn't go according to plan. But, you know, we see the Indians getting steamed a lot lately. And again, they've been steamed throughout the season. People really thinking highly of this team, as they should. Now they're starting to play like it, and the market is responding the way that we expected them to. More money coming in against Jeremy Hellickson on Tuesday. That was the Cardinals-Phillies. That's not a big surprise. Michael Pineda went from about minus 230 on the open to as high as minus 310 against the Angels there. Pineda has been a guy, big ERA to xFIP outlier over the last couple of years. The sharp guys in the market that do play those early numbers do look to play on the sabermetrics, betting him up quite a bit in that start. Market came in against Julio Teheran and the Braves on Tuesday. That was against the Giants. The market does not like Teheran this year. I know I don't. I've talked about some of those injury indicators in his profile. I would expect to see money continue to come in against him as we go throughout the season here. Money came in on Nick Martinez, I should say, on Tuesday. That happens every time Nick Martinez starts. So again, if you're somebody that wants to get out there in front of the numbers, bet numbers and not teams, fade Nick Martinez on the overnights. You probably should get some closing line value out of that. Irvin Santana took on money against Derek Holland and the Chicago White Sox. White Sox fade against right-handed pitching continues. Santana has those clear regression signs, but the market siding with him over Derek Holland, not a big surprise, though. Derek Holland is a guy that, you know, not only had signs of regression, but it hit for him. And when it hits, people kind of take notice. You know, the public starts to notice and says, oh, well, this guy, you know, he's not pitching well lately. I'm going to bet against him. You know, a lot of guys just look at Irvin Santana and say, oh, he's got this 220, 240, 260, whatever his ERA is now. Say, oh, he's pitching really well. They don't really tend to look below the surface at some of those advanced metrics. So you get that initial move, and then you get the piggyback move from people that are just betting on the traditional numbers. That's what we saw there in that spot. Brandon McCarthy got steamed into a much bigger favorite. That was a Mets-Dodgers game. Robert Gesellman on the hill there for the Mets. McCarthy closed about minus 230. I think it opened minus 190. Brandon McCarthy has been really underrated this year. he's been absolutely terrific. People don't realize that in a rotation that's got Clayton Kershaw, Rich Hill, the stuff that Alex Wood has done this year, McCarthy's been really, really good. And I'm not surprised that we saw some line value on him there on Tuesday. Wednesday, we had a getaway day game between the Marlins and the Nationals. That was Max Scherzer and Dan Straley. Money came in against Max Scherzer in that one. That'll give you some kind of idea on how strongly the sharp players out there love the Miami Marlins. Just as a quick side note, I'm seeing a lot of articles here. Has Max Scherzer surpassed Clayton Kershaw? And the answer is no. Max Scherzer is elite. Absolutely. Max Scherzer is phenomenal. Clayton Kershaw is otherworldly. I love both of these guys, but Scherzer had a big home run hiccup a couple of years ago that, you know, kind of got swept under the rug a little bit because he's so dominant from a strikeout standpoint. It's great to have the narratives and the clickbait stuff out there, but no, Max Scherzer has not surpassed Clayton Kershaw. Again, I love Max Scherzer. Credit to him for what he's doing this year. Yes, Kershaw hasn't been as dominant as he usually is. The guy's still really, really, really good. And he's the best pitcher on the planet as far as I'm concerned. So, interesting to see that. Just wanted to shed some light on my thoughts on that subject. We saw an Erasmo Ramirez fade and the Rays. That game actually went down to a money line pick'em against Cincinnati in that spot with Tim Adelman on the hill. I agreed with the move. I thought it was a little bit significant, maybe a little bit bigger than I thought. But Erasmo Ramirez has not pitched well as a starter. Pitched pretty well in that game, and then the Reds' bullpen just totally imploded. But that was a pretty big move, and one that I was kind of stunned to see. Carlos Carrasco steamed heavily. That was a fade of Kevin Gausman. That was a fade of the Orioles. That was a buy on the Indians. Indians won that one. And again, as I mentioned, Andrew Miller pitched really well there in relief in that one. Saw a huge Jordan Montgomery and Yankees move against the Angels. That move about as much as 50 cents out there in the marketplace. That was a pretty significant move there on Montgomery, but I do like Montgomery a lot. Again, in terms of the Yankees rotation, he's overshadowed by bigger names, but he may be the most consistent guy in that rotation right now, and he was good in his start yesterday. Thursday, we're seeing a Jose Quintana fade, even with Chicago facing a left-hander in Nick Turley. Early start, so it doesn't matter much for our listeners out there, but a little bit surprising. White Sox are a Pythagorean win-loss outlier. Could be some market movement based on that. But what they've done against lefties this year has been really impressive, and I think Quintana, you know, better than he's pitched. I talked about that a bit in my picks analysis piece today. Money coming in against Antonio Senzatella and the Rockies. It's the right move. I mean, I'm not stepping in front of the Rockies train right now, but Senzatella is the weak link of that starting rotation, and I'm not surprised to see a move like that. Nobody's willing to lay $1.60 with Atlanta, that number coming down into the 140 range. Jaime Garcia, Matt Cain in that one. I think that's reasonable. The Giants are very bad, but laying $1.60 with Atlanta is not a good way to make money this season, I don't think. My pick for Thursday night, I like this one. I don't love this one. It's a limited amount of games available here for today, but I will take the Indians and Mike Clevenger over the Baltimore Orioles and Wade Miley. Wade Miley has hit regression. It has been very ugly. Has been exactly what we expected. And the Indians offense has gotten going here lately. They've been much better against left-handed pitching than they were at the start of the year. But I like Mike Clevenger against this Baltimore lineup. Lots of ugly swings and misses on breaking and off-speed stuff from a right-handed arm slot in this series for the Baltimore hitters. Clevenger has a good changeup. He's got a pretty decent slider as well, slider curve, however you want to classify it. Yes, the fastball command is a worry. Yes, that is my concern here in this start. But when you look at Clevenger and the high walk rate, it's mitigated a little bit here because the Orioles are so aggressive offensively. They dive out at a lot of stuff. Clevenger has a quirky motion. It's a deceptive delivery. It's something that if you haven't seen it a whole lot, it can be a little bit difficult for you to pick up on. Clevenger has had success the first time through the lineup. Sometimes that control and command issue pops up the second time through. So I think the first five is the way to go here tonight. Also because Cody Allen not available, his wife just gave birth to their first kid. Andrew Miller pitched two innings yesterday, and Terry Francona said a bug up his ass about Andrew Miller's workload. So the Indians' back end of the bullpen could look very, very different tonight. Be wary of that in the late innings. It weakens the pick a little bit for a full game, but I do think the Indians' first five is a pretty decent look here for tonight's action. And again, the Indians are just – I think they've flipped the switch now. You know, better feelings, they're getting more hits. This was a frustrated ball club for a while. I talked about this a lot earlier in the season where, in terms of high leverage plate appearances, they had very little luck. They had the highest BABIP against with runners in scoring position, one of the lowest BABIPs for with runners in scoring position. That has all changed now. It just changes the dynamic of a team. You know, when you're expected to win 95 games and cruise to the division, and you're running so badly in these sequencing metrics, it's frustrating. And a lot of guys were pressing. Now, a lot of guys have relaxed. Everything looks a lot better. Everything's going as it was expected. The monkey is off this team's back, and I think that's what it truly means to flip the switch there, is to get some more fortunate outcomes in those decisive situations. That's been the case for the Indians here this year. So I wanted to mention, as I talked about in that down the line segment, we've seen a lot of line moves based on left on base percentage. I want to throw out a few names for you so that you can look to get ahead of some of the overnight moves on some of these guys. Lance Lynn, market has faded him a lot, so you're going to have to be very vigilant in jumping out in front of this one. But he has an 85.8% left on base percentage with a 3.33 ERA, 5.30 FIP, 4.60 xFIP. Urban Santana, 84.7% left on base percentage, 2.97 ERA, 4.80 FIP, 4.92 xFIP. Gio Gonzalez, an 84.5% left on base percentage, 2.96 ERA, 4.28 FIP, 4.38 xFIP. Jason Vargas, 84.2% left on base percentage, 2.27 FIP, 3.22 or 2.27 ERA, 3.22 FIP, 4.68 xFIP. Now, the xFIP there is interesting because he's not a really the xFIP is interesting with a lot of these guys because Santana, Gonzalez, Vargas, generally speaking, they're well below the league average home run to fly ball percentage. So the xFIP is misleading, but the left on base percentage is in line for regression. So this isn't an ERA to xFIP play. This is a left on base percentage play. So I just want to make the distinction there between those. Robbie Ray, 83% left on base percentage, 287 ERA, 342 FIP, 357 xFIP. Now he strikes out a lot of guys, but still, you know, he seems like a guy that is overachieving a little bit here this season. Also, Ariel Miranda in Seattle, 81.1% left on base percentage, 404 ERA, 519 FIP, 528 xFIP. We've seen money come in against him a couple of times here this season. I think we'll keep seeing it as we go throughout, especially for as long as he's carrying a left on base percentage above 80%. Some guys on the other side of that now, some guys with some low left on base percentages. Tanner Roark, guy I like, guy I've talked about a lot this season. 488 ERA, 433 FIP, 442 xFIP. The command profile hasn't been great, but a 65.1% left on base percentage. Should see some positive gains with that. Jake Arrieta, who goes tonight, 65.8% left on base percentage, 464 ERA, 408 FIP, 376 xFIP. Jeff Samardzija, 65.9% left on base percentage, 474 FIP, 474 ERA, 348 FIP, 3.00 xFIP. Then Sean Manaea, 66.9% left on base percentage, 405 ERA, 451 FIP, 384 xFIP. One thing I do want to note, though, about if you sort the column over at Fangraphs by lowest left on base percentage, if you look up and down the list, you're not going to see a lot of command. You'll see guys like Matt Moore, Jake Arrieta, Jeff Samardzija, Trevor Bauer, Rick Porcello, Gerard Eichhoff, Masahiro Tanaka. These guys have bad left on base percentages because they don't have good command this year. It is easier to bet on negative regression than on positive regression. So, you know, yeah, some of these low left on base percentage guys should get better. But again, that assumes a reasonable level of command. Same thing with the ERA to xFIP thing. You got to have command. If you don't have command, it doesn't matter how many guys you strike out, doesn't matter what your walk rate is. If you're not locating in the zone and staying off the barrel, you're going to struggle. That's just how it goes. So when you're looking at that left on base percentage chart, look for the guys that are getting truly unlucky, the guys that have pitched with decent command but haven't had a whole lot of success in those high leverage plate appearances. Several series to look at here for this weekend, beginning with Toronto and Kansas City. A couple of teams playing very well. Toronto, one of the best in baseball over the last little while. Jay Happ, Jake Junis on Friday. Marco Estrada, Jason Vargas on Saturday. Francisco Liriano, Jason Hamill on Sunday. I'm a bigger believer in the Blue Jays than the Royals. That shouldn't come as a surprise. I've talked negatively about the Royals for a while now. But the biggest problem for the Blue Jays, as far as I see it right now, has been that John Gibbons has no clue how to put together a starting lineup. You know, he's got his better hitters getting fewer plate appearances than his worst hitters. It just doesn't make sense to me. Toronto has made some lineup overhauls. Josh Donaldson was very vocal about this in the middle of the week, saying that, you know, we need to score more runs. And here's one of the reasons we're not scoring a whole lot of runs. Seems like Gibbons kind of took that to heart a little bit. It's a big litmus test for both teams. I think Toronto has the pitching matchup advantages in this series. I think they have the better lineup. The bullpen is a little bit shaky. They've got some injuries and things of that sort. But I do think that Toronto, decent series look here in this one against the Royals. Houston and Seattle, Joe Musgrove and the return of Felix Hernandez on Friday. Lance McCullers comes off the DL to take on Sam Gaviglio on Saturday. Brad Peacock, Ariel Miranda on Sunday. Mariners, I like them against right-handed pitching. They're catching three of them here in this series. McCullers and Peacock are strikeout guys, so we'll have to see how that whole thing plays out. But the Mariners, their lefties have been getting it going a little bit. Nelson Cruz having another big year. They've been a very good offensive team, and there haven't been a whole lot of people that have solved Houston's pitching staff this year. Kind of curious to see what happens in this series. As I mentioned, the return of King Felix on Friday, McCullers back on Saturday. Be very wary of guys coming off the DL. We had an interesting article about Brad Peacock over at Fangraphs calling him a strikeout king. I didn't realize it really, but Peacock has missed a ton of bats this season. Curious to see what happens with the narrative with him. Ariel Miranda's already one of those high left on base guys. I think you hit Houston on the overnight for Sunday's game. I think you catch some serious line value there in that one because I think they're going to move quite a bit on Sunday with that Peacock-Miranda matchup. Still wondering if Houston's going to ease off the gas a little bit. But, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe this is just a really talented team. They have great depth as well. So guys don't get tired. A.J. Hinch manages his players so well, manages leverage spots in the bullpen so well. Maybe Houston's just in this thing for the long haul. Maybe they're just going to keep blowing away this division, blowing away pretty much everybody at this stage of the game. The Cubs and the Marlins. Marlins, still lots of love for this team. Are the Cubs still overpriced? Well, we may find out a little bit in this series with some of these line moves, but there are not a whole lot of favorable pitching matchups in this series for Miami. Jake Arrieta, Jeff Locke today, John Lackey, Jose Urena tomorrow on Friday, John Lester, Justin Nicolino Saturday, Mike Montgomery, Edinson Volquez on Sunday. Do the sharp players keep pushing this Marlins team? They've been playing the overnights on the Marlins a lot. Marlins have a very good lineup. Pitching matchups do not favor them in this series. The Cubs have a good bullpen. The Marlins bullpen's coming around. I just want to watch this one from a betting market standpoint. I want to see how the lines go for this series. I'm not necessarily interested in the results, but I'm interested in watching this one and seeing the dynamics out there in the betting market. The Rockies and the Dodgers. Do we finally see Colorado's regression? Kyle Freeland and Alex Wood on Friday. Tyler Chatwood, Clayton Kershaw Saturday. Herman Marquez and Brandon McCarthy on Sunday. At the risk of sounding like an idiot, which I've done a few times this year, I'm going to put the odds of the Dodgers sweeping well above the odds of Colorado winning this series. This looks to me like one of those spots where the Rockies have been playing over their head. They've been playing over their heads quite a bit on the road. This looks like a spot for regression. They're getting the three best Dodger starters in this one. I like the Dodgers to sweep this series. I don't know if you can find odds out there for a sweep. I think that's probably a worthwhile investment. But I would definitely put the odds of a Dodgers sweep well above the odds of Colorado winning the series. Mathematically, that's probably true as well. But this looks like a situation for the Dodgers to go, hey, we're the Dodgers. You're the Rockies. This is how it's going to be the rest of the way. I don't know if it will be that way the rest of the way, but this looks to me like a series where the Dodgers should very clearly have the upper hand, and they certainly do from the pitching matchup standpoint. I'd be curious to see the market movement for these as well, because Wood, Kershaw, and McCarthy, it wouldn't shock me if all these numbers are minus 170 or higher. Maybe minus 180 or higher. And I think that will be a true test of what the market thinks of Colorado. Because when you look at through the three teams here in the West that are playing so well, I mean, the results are there. Colorado's played well. They've staved off regression. You know, they're right up there with the Dodgers. But these numbers are going to be very, very big in this series. And I want to see who's willing to bite that bullet and take Colorado in any of these games. And I just don't know if it's going to happen. One more series here I'm not particularly interested in, but it's Pittsburgh and St. Louis. Jameson Taillon, Adam Wainwright Friday. Garrett Cole, Lance Lynn Saturday. Chad Kuhl, Mike Leake on Sunday. Reason I bring this up, it's Sunday Night Baseball. The Pirates are off. The Cardinals host the Reds. So we don't get a spot here to play on Monday. I got accused on Twitter of using Sunday Night Baseball into Monday as an autoplay spot. That's not the case. I have not advocated fading a traveling team on Monday after playing Sunday Night Baseball every time. It's only in cases when you get big situational edges. The Astros and A's didn't work out on Monday. I totally understand that. But it makes perfect sense to me, and hopefully it makes perfect sense to a lot of our listeners as well, to fade a Houston team after playing Boston, a past World Series champion, a World Series contender, going out to Oakland, long travel, shitty ballpark, bad venue. It made sense. Yes, Brad Peacock pitched well. Yes, Oakland's lineup is inconsistent. Yes, the A's are an underachiever this year. But that was a spot that I believed in. It was a spot that I thought was a good one for us. I do not call the game on Monday an autoplay. It was not an autoplay because it was a travel spot either. It was a great situational spot, but I thought Daniel Gossett making his second start would be a good one. I thought with Houston, you know, coming out of the series that they, if Houston's playing Kansas City or Minnesota or something in that Sunday night game, no, I don't make that play. They were playing Boston. They played David Price. That's why I like that spot for Oakland on Monday. It didn't come through. I totally get it. But it was not solely because of the Sunday Night Baseball travel spot. So I want to make sure that my words are not being mixed up there, that I'm not being misinterpreted. The situational spot was a big angle, yes. But it wasn't the Sunday Night Baseball spot. It had a lot more to do with it. It had a lot more than that going on. So I just want to make that very clear here because, you know, I didn't really – maybe I didn't make myself clear. I tried to in my responses on Twitter. Maybe I do overblow situational spots. They're certainly not as important in baseball as they are in the other sports. I don't think that at all. But that one was a good one. And you were getting an Oakland team at home at plus 135, plus 140. There was value in that. Didn't work out. It is what it is. But we don't have a spot here coming out of Sunday Night Baseball this week. So we don't have to worry about it. So, talking about a lot of things on today's show. Again, please hit up those college football articles over at bangthebook.com. Hoping to do some more of that stuff here as we go throughout the offseason. We'll have another edition of the Bettors Box plus a Monday mailbag coming your way on Monday. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. Happy, smart, safe weekend. And remember that you will never strike out when you're in the Bettors Box.